FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia will be talking about miseducation, how climate change is taught in America.
Oh, can you take care of her? Oh, maybe you can spare her several moments of your consideration leading up to the final destination.
This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Our guest tonight is Katie Wirth. Katie is the author of Miseducation, How Climate Change is Taught in America. She'll be speaking on March 30th at 6 p.m. on the Chico State campus at Calusa Hall 100. Her visit is part of the CSU faculty learning community on teaching climate change and resilience.
Katie is an Emmy and Edward R. Murrow Award-winning investigative journalist from 2015 to 2021. She worked for the PBS series Frontline on enterprise investigations and multimedia stories about science and politics. Her work has appeared in Scientific American, National Geographic, Slate, The Wall Street Journal, and was included in the Best American Science and Nature Writing for 2016.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland, a financial advisor with Edward Jones in Chico. No matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, college savings accounts, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-8913 on the corner of 3rd Avenue and the Esplanade, Yale Nellen Edward Jones Member, SIPC. We're also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by J&J Automotive in Chico. With over 19 years of experience in auto repair and scheduled maintenance, specialize in Subaru and Volvo. J&J provides everything from manufacturer-suggested vehicle maintenance to all types of repairs, including transmission and engine repair, brake and suspension, tune-ups, lubes, filters, lights, and more. To book an appointment or for more information, visit jandjautomotivechico.com and at 530-891-3328. We'll take a short break right here and be back to talk with Katie Wirth in just a moment.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and on the phone with us now is Katie Wirth, investigative journalist and author of Miseducation, How Climate Change is Taught in America. We read you her credentials a little bit earlier, but I'm going to repeat them. She's an Emmy and Edward R. Murrow Award-winning investigative journalist. From 2015 to 21, she worked for PBS Frontline on Enterprise Investigations, multimedia stories about science and politics. She's also published in Scientific American, National Geographic, Slate, The Wall Street Journal, and one of her articles was included in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2016. Welcome, Katie Wirth. We're happy to have you on Ecotopia.
Hi, I'm really glad to be here.
In reading about your work, and as I just recited, we know you've written on a wide range of topics in science, nature, and politics. What made you decide you wanted to write about climate change and how it's being taught in American schools?
Well, so I worked for several years for the PBS investigative series Frontline, and while I was there, I was assigned a story about climate change in the Marshall Islands, which is the Pacific island nation in the middle, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere, at least compared to where we are. They are a nation that's kind of famously endangered by climate change because they're on average about 6 feet above sea level, and their highest point is less than 20 feet above sea level. So you can imagine that sea level rise is a big threat. And we were there and we were talking to children while we were there for this story. And it was just remarkable how fluently they could talk about climate change. You know, they knew what was causing it, what the impacts would be, what the impacts on their life would be, which is more than a lot of adults can say here that I know. And you know, they, you know, it was partly because they learned about it at school every year. So one of the kids that we were talking to was this 9-year-old named Iserman, and his family was considering moving to Oklahoma where they had some extended family. And so, you know, the obvious question to me, the reporting question was, okay, well, if Iserman moves to Oklahoma, what might he learn about climate change there? And that was sort of like one of the questions that birthed this reporting, and I was able to answer it much later. I went to Enid, Oklahoma, as part of my reporting, and went to a high school there, and I talked to five teens whose families had all immigrated from the Marshall Islands. Iserman's family did not immigrate in the end, and four of those five said that I was the first adult that they'd ever heard say the words climate change on school grounds.
Oh my gosh. Did this start out as a story and then grew into a book? I mean, were you just kind of extending, working on the story of what is being taught in schools?
Yeah, so anyone who's familiar with Frontline probably knows that it's a documentary series, so that we do, you know, long-form documentaries. And so for a while, this was going to be a documentary, but it was sort of we started a film, but it was sort of derailed by the pandemic, like so many other things.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the reporting had kind of grown quite sprawling and enough to fill a book. I was also reporting on climate denialism and you know, what had found that there were a lot of attempts to kind of influence what kids learned about climate change by moneyed interests. And so it just seemed like there was enough to fill out, you know, a small book. It's not a hefty one, but at least a small book. So that's how it kind of became a book.
So how did you go about doing your research? You talked about your visit to the Marshall Islands and then to Oklahoma. How did you go about doing the research, gathering the information? What did you include in your research?
A lot of it was on the ground reporting. I just tried to talk to as many teachers and students and parents, folks who were paying attention to education, and as I could. And what I found was one of the reasons I thought this was, you know, worthy of some serious reporting is that there's just a remarkable amount of tension around this issue. You know, most science teachers that I spoke to said that at some point they'd gotten pushback either from a student, from a parent, from their administrators, from other colleagues about how they taught climate change or didn't teach climate change. So it's because it's become such a political issue.
Really?
It's playing out in these places that we send our kids, and so, you know, I talked to a probably a few hundred teachers over the course of a few years. And, you know, just kind of did try and get a picture of what the landscape was out there. And then I also, of course, did, you know, an academic, a deep dive into the into academia and what surveys had been done about it. There hasn't been a ton of research about it, but there have been some really key surveys, including one that looked at interviewed about 1,500 science teachers and found that most did mention climate change in class, but not very much. Most said that they spent between 0 and 2 hours on the topic, which isn't really enough to give students a real, like, good understanding of what's happening. And then a lot of those teachers, about a third of teachers, said that they gave students information, or, you know, kind of told students that, oh, we don't know what's happening, it might be natural, it might be human caused, which is not consistent with the actual science on the issue.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your title, Miss Education. Did you pick that, or our experience with publishers, we never published a book that where the publisher didn't change the title on us.
Yeah, that was definitely the publisher's choice, but it is apropos.
Right, because we hear a lot about miseducation. I mean, it attracts a lot of headlines. It sounds like what you're saying already, that it might be an absence of education or an absence of awareness, although maybe some of the teachers are, in fact, miseducating their kids. If you could clarify that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's kind of all over the board. There is certainly the phenomenon of teachers themselves not having learned the science, and, you know, it wasn't taught to them in school or even in college, and then they're kind of expected to teach it, and they're kind of passing on information that they're getting, which may or may not be accurate, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about climate change, right? And then, you know, there's also been a concerted effort to misinform and miseducate children on this issue. So, for example, there's a conservative think tank named the Heartland Institute that it operates out of Chicago that mailed a book about basically a climate denial book to every science teacher in America in 2017, I think it was, or so they claim to. They definitely sent out at least 100,000 copies. And most of the science teachers I spoke to had received one, and, you know, most of them threw it away right away because it just was clear to them that it wasn't accurate science. But some of them, I talked to some teachers who knew someone who had used it in class, who, you know, and it's hard to blame the teachers who did, you know, they're busy, they barely have time to, you know, pee in the day, so somebody sends them these lesson plans that look snazzy and, you know, just they're ready to impart to students, they're not gonna they may not throw them out, they may use them.
A couple of questions that are related to that. Somewhere in what I read about you're talking about this book, or I listened to a couple of interviews that you did, that it's a red-blue breakdown of where science is taught correctly and where it's not.
Yeah.
Could you say something more about that?
Yeah, that was one of the takeaways. In a way, it's not, I guess probably it's intuitive to a lot of people that there is this red-blue divide over climate change. But, you know, there is just no divide in the science, right? So, you know, there's this often thrown about statistic that 97% of scientists agree, and that is about a 20-year-old statistic, and the more recent ones, more recent surveys have found that 100% of climate scientists say that this is human caused, and they're in the recent literature, there's nothing that's peer-reviewed that's saying that there's no evidence for any other cause, basically. So, you know, the fact that there's a large portion of America that thinks that doesn't believe that, that doesn't know that, that thinks that, well, we don't really know, maybe it's natural, maybe it's human, is a big problem. And, you know, the divide is, what we found is that you can, like, roughly guess what a kid might learn about the phenomenon of climate change just by knowing whether they were, you know, they're learning about it in a red state or a blue state. And, you know, that's partly because of the connection, you know, the state representative, state government has a say over state science standards, which then kind of filters down into classrooms. And, you know, it's troublesome because, of course, climate change doesn't stop at the state border if you're to check who's running your state legislature. It's like if it's as though kids in some states were taught that the earth was flat, of who was running their state legislature.
Were any teachers that you talked to kind of adamant science deniers, or were most of them, well, we don't really know? We read this. Yeah. I just have to say this funny thing. We read this thing in the paper this morning about a kindergarten class where a teacher was chanting to the children, "Who's our president?" And the children would chant Biden, and then the teacher would say, "What was it, Steve?"
It was the equivalent of "out with Biden."
Yeah,
the
out with
kids
Biden.
Were chanting and jumping around.
Kindergartners. So this was a teacher, yes, who, you know, was politically motivated in a kindergarten class. So I wondered if any of that came out as you talked to teachers, that a political motivation.
Yeah, there is that political motivation. I mean, teachers are just people, mm-hmm. of course, and so they're all over the political spectrum, and some of them, I would say this is not that common, but some of them definitely bring their politics into the classroom, mm-hmm. and to hear that that happened in a kindergarten is really especially
Wasn't that just astounding? Yeah.
But, you know, I as you know, I'm actually from Chico. I grew up in Chico, graduated from Chico High School, and I went to Chico Junior High. And in my course of my reporting, I went to Chico Junior High and talked to a wonderful science teacher there, Kristen Del Real. And she's a sixth grade teacher, I believe, and she makes a point to teach her students every year about climate change, the science of it, and do solutions projects that the kids start brainstorming, you know, how can we solve these problems? There's hope. There's a way out of this. And let's roll up our sleeves and get to work on it. And then she told me a story of one year, you know, the kids started coming in really grumpy about their solutions projects and, you know, not wanting to do it, saying mm-hmm. it's dumb. And it turned out that they were leaving her science class and going into a history class, where they were being shown videos from kind of an ultra-right organization that was saying that climate change is just a hoax, that it's scientists are just making it up for prestige and money. And so they were hearing these two totally different stories about climate change from two different adults that they trusted, right? Mm-hmm. And one of them was not consistent with the science. And so, of course, they were quite confused. You know, they're just kids, and it's hard to sort out when you're that age what's happening when you get those mixed messages. So just to say that there is a lot of, that it does come into classrooms.
Right.
But I think, you know, most teachers are just really trying to do the right thing and, you know, get their kids educated, and sometimes they're spreading misinformation as they do so, but most of them are not.
So did kids ever have passions in either directions, the kids that you talked to? And what, did you focus on a particular grade level, or did you go all the way through?
Yeah, I focused a lot on middle school. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, I just want to say, of course, people, we all learn about things outside of school. So kids are learning about climate change. They're running into it on their phones and their social media, also in museums, you know, lots of different contexts. They're hearing about it, as, you know, in church and, you know, all kinds of places. So school is only one place that they might run into it. But there's something important about what happens in school, because it's sort of an institution that touches everyone. So it's kind of like, you know, or almost everyone anyway. Not everyone obviously goes to public school, but, you know, it's a kind of an equalizing, it has this equalizing effect. Like what's happening in schools, public schools, has an influence on, it's sort of like the bare minimum that we can expect a kid to become an adult knowing. And so I looked at middle schools, especially because middle school is the last time kids have to take any earth science, and climate change most like kind of best fits into earth and environmental science. But, you know, in high school, they may not take earth or environmental science. Those are electives. So, so yeah, I kind of wound up looking most, you know, if a kid is, if there's, they're going to be required to learn anything about climate change, it's probably going to be in middle school science. And that's true in California.
Did you find any curricula that added climate change or as a particular topic, like would teach a course on climate change or teach something where climate change was a major topic?
Yeah, I think there are, there's a whole range. There's some schools that have classes in climate change. I spoke to a teacher who taught that class in a New York City school. But there's also some states are approaching climate change not just as a science issue or not even just as a social studies issue, but New Jersey, for example, adopted new academic standards that insert climate change in English class and math class. You can, you know, look, do equations about climate change. You can learn about it in health class. And just kind of like peppering it in developmentally appropriate ways throughout a kid's curriculum, so they kind of wind up with a robust, it's not just this one unit that they learn once in eighth grade, it's that they're kind of getting a little bit of information about it all over the place, and they wind up with a robust understanding of what, of the world that they're graduating into and that they're going to have to navigate.
Katie Worth, I wanted to ask you, I appreciate your term, robust learning there. And I wanted to raise a question that's nagged at me for years, and that's the discrepancy between the standards, the textbooks, the lectures, and what kids go away with. There's always the assumption if we teach it, they will learn. And demonstrably, that's not true. And I wondered, even when people are doing a good job of teaching climate change, are they teaching it by indoctrination, not necessarily a bad indoctrination? Is there room for kids like the Marshall Islanders to relate it to their own lives and make connections?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a whole variety of how kids learn about it and are taught about it. Sometimes it's just a single unit where they're just learning the basics of it. But in other cases, teachers put a lot of effort into kind of letting the kids think about it scientifically, like scientists themselves, you know, and come to their own conclusion. Look at the data, you know. I mean, the thing about climate change is the climate is a very complex system, but climate change, what's causing the climate change is very kind of almost elegantly simple, which is that we're pumping billions of tons a day of atmosphere warming gases into the atmosphere, and sure enough, the atmosphere warms, you know. So you look at that, you just can look at the data of the, you know, you can understand that, and then you can look at the data and you can come to your own conclusion about what's happening with a few experiments, with looking, you know, and that is actually a much more powerful way for kids to learn than just memorizing.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So you said you looked at textbooks as well. How was climate change addressed in the textbooks?
Well, so I looked at all of the most popular middle school science textbooks in the country, and most of them had some good information about it, but almost all of them also simultaneously had this that information was sort of undermined with this doubtful language. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, there'd be a whole paragraph, couple paragraphs about human-caused climate change, and then there'd be a line like, well, many scientists believe that mm-hmm. humans are causing climate change. Some propose that it's natural. Or things like, you know, climate change could have some positive effects and some less positive effects. Mm-hmm. So all of the effects are going to be positive, some are just going to be less positive. So those are direct quotes from some of the most popular textbooks in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of like irresolute language may seem like it's subtle. But they're, you know, they allow kids to think that, like, oh, the science, we don't really know. Maybe we don't really know. People still don't know. And that's a problem because textbooks are seen as this authority, you know, and teachers defer to them. And, you know, I think there's actually been some studies that show that kids that read that kind of really doubtful language come away with a much fuzzier understanding of climate change than kids who just mm-hmm. get the information, mm-hmm. the, like, straight information from a textbook.
Well, and there's also the notion of equivalence that I think plagues journalism these days, where you say, well, there are two sides for every story, so we have to present them both, even though they may not be equal in terms of their truth value.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not an accident that this is happening. It's not that the people mm-hmm. writing the textbooks don't know what the science is. It's that, you know, they have to sell textbooks in places like Texas
which, yeah. You know, notorious.
And so they kind of put in this, like, cagey language in order to bypass the Texas State Board of Education, mm-hmm. effectively. And then that same textbook is then sold across the country. So it's a big problem.
Yeah, even in places, of course, that would not accept that equivalency type language, have to buy those textbooks because those are the textbooks that are being broadly made available to teachers. Yeah, we've been through that in our former career in academia.
Interesting.
I'm really interested in all that you had to say about kind of big power and big money,
yes,
and their influence on what happens in the schools. And mm-hmm. you, in the promotional materials for your books, whoever wrote it, connect the dots on corporations, state legislators, legislatures, school boards, libertarian think tanks, conservative lobbyists, and textbook publishers, all of whom have learned from the fight over evolution and tobacco. And I'd really like to talk about this quite a bit because I think that that kind of influence on what happens in the schools is a little bit appalling.
Yeah, it's really shocking. And I think that's part of what drew me to this subject is, you know, I think we'd like to think that we keep the adult politics from dripping into our kids' mm-hmm. lives, at least to some extent, but that's not always the case. And, you know, so first of all, the fossil fuel companies and the fossil fuel industry has a lot to answer for on this issue. So, you know, like the fossil fuel industry has kind of been pushing their messages into schools for a long time, like in the 1950s. Maybe some of your older listeners will even remember this, but the American Petroleum Institute created this program called the Magic Barrel.
Sent these,
you know, basically fossil fuel employees out to schools all over America. Hundreds of thousands of children saw this about the kind of all the magic that fits into a barrel of oil, you know, and it just left kids. The point was to leave kids with kind of a positive view of the industry. And, you know, that kind of thing still happens. So, you know, I was sitting in a seventh grade science classroom in Arkansas one day when this representative of Arkansas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners, which is like an industry association in Arkansas, showed up with this PowerPoint presentation for the seventh graders about fossil fuels. And there was a lot of good information in there. There was, like, you know, the history of fossil fuels, where they could be found, the geology, the technology that's used to extract the fuels. But then there was also a portion of it that was where they were kind of really, really downplaying climate change. So being like, sure, yeah, there's this thing, there's these carbon, you know, emissions that come with using fossil fuels, but if you use wind, you know, that kills birds. And if you use solar power, you're going to need to mine rare earth minerals, and that's a big problem too. So, like, she says every source of energy is going to come with some kind of problem. So it's kind of like, well, who knows? You know, like, they're all problematic, so let's keep using the easiest one.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, it's just kind of the kids were left with this message that, you know, climate change is just not something that they need to really be worried about. And that fossil fuels would be great to have a career in fossil fuel industry. And, you know, it just was very, very clear marketing to children.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any sense, or were you able to discover how widespread that sort of thing is, where, you know, certain industrial or corporate representatives go in and present sort of their side of the issue? I hadn't heard of that before, and that's pretty could have a pretty big impact, I would think.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's happening. It happens in some states that have very well organized fossil fuel industry associations. I know that it happens in Oklahoma quite a lot. In fact, there's like a school book called what's it called? Freddy Fuelless. And another one about, you know, the big bad dream. This kid that wakes up without any fossil fuel products in his life, and it's a nightmare.
These
are school books for like 6-year-old kids, you know. And in Texas, there's organizations that will go school to school and, you know, have industry mentors for the kids. And I just was doing a bunch of reporting in Texas, actually, because they just approved a new set of science standards. And there's a group called the Texas Energy Council that worked very hard to water down the climate standards there, and successfully they managed to water down the climate standards in Texas, which, as we were talking about earlier, has a big impact on textbooks that are then sold around the country.
I wanted to go into that a little bit more, the state legislatures and their impact. Does that break down blue and red too, as you looked at things like the standards or curriculum?
Creation. For anybody who doesn't know what a standard, an academic standard is, most people probably do, but it's just basically like, you know, in fourth grade math, kids are expected by the end of the year to know long division, say, or something like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So like each grade, each subject, there's expectations of what the kids will learn or know by the end of the year. And so in most states, those standards have to be updated every 6, 8, 10 years. And that is a political process. So, you know, they'll have a group of educators that propose a new set of standards or an updated set of standards, but then that has to go for the state board of education or the state legislature, usually, for approval. And, you know, it's not like a one-to-one, you know, it's not like every red state doesn't talk about climate change and every blue state does. But you can definitely see the influence. Every blue state does have standards that address climate change. There's not a single blue state that doesn't. But the red states are all over the map. So there's, you know, some red states that actually do a very good job. But I think there's 6 red states that get an F, you know, kind of do do nothing or actually push misinformation. There's a bunch of states that just kind of do a subpar job at it, if red states, and that's because of this political influence from the state legislature.
I wonder if we could extend this a little bit to who makes those decisions about what kids should know or be able to do. I don't know where it fit into the writing of your book, but we have this newish movement started in Virginia about parents and their right to determine what shall be taught and learned in the schools, and interpretations of that vary. There are many parents now who say, I will determine what my kid learns, as opposed to some other parents who say, I will leave it to the teachers that I've hired to figure it out, but I want to have a say in what's going on there. Do you have thoughts about that movement and how it might be affected education and climate change?
I mean, it's tricky. I mean, there's a lot to be said for local control of education.
Yes.
And also, you don't want that local control to be able to, miseducate your kids, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want kids in some community to be taught that tobacco doesn't cause cancer or that the earth is flat just because mm-hmm. the parents there happen to be that. I mean, those are just, examples, but, there also has to be a standard that no matter what community a kid grows up in, when they go to public school, they're going to learn the truth. They're not going to learn a whole lot of lies a whole bunch of political rhetoric that is not consistent with reality, right? It's an equity issue, right? Like, you just want kids in every community to just get a good education. And so, I don't have an answer to that. I know there's a lot of perspectives on it, but I think we can all agree that we want the kids to be getting real, legitimate information in their public school.
You said that you talked to parents. I'm just so curious about what people said when you were talking to them. You said that you talked with parents as well, and were there any parents who were unhappy with what was going on in school, or who wanted an alternative to what was being presented to their kids?
Yeah, as you might expect, there's people on both ends of that spectrum. So, there were parents who really felt like they wanted their kids to be learning about climate change in every state, because of course there's no actual red or blue states. Like, every state is some variety of purple,
right?
And so there's people, and of course there's plenty of people across the spectrum, no matter what their political affiliation is, that trust the science about climate change and don't have that skepticism about it. And and so, yeah, there's lots, the reason that the standards aren't worse than they are is because parents have fought, science teachers, parents, students have gone to their state legislatures, have gone to their state boards of education and their local districts saying, no, we want this, we have to tell the truth in these standards. We can't water it down. Kids deserve to have this information about the world, about the century that they were born into, what it's going to look like, And so, there's plenty of people who are really fired up about this. And then, of course, there's people who just are very politically kind of ideological and want their kids to kind of only learn, to only be exposed to information that is consistent with that political ideology and get mad that their kids have to learn it in school.
You have a chapter in your book, and I think you already gave us an example of this. Selling kids on fossil fuels, is that the example of having somebody from a petroleum company or whatever come in and give presentations?
Yeah. I mean, it's very clear that the American Petroleum Institute especially has worked pretty hard to influence what kids understand about climate change. So, in fact, in 1998, this may seem like ancient history to some, but it still has repercussions today. There was a meeting by the American Petroleum Institute that included, you know, they had representatives from Chevron, Shell, Exxon, et cetera, at this meeting, and they were strategizing about how to make the public doubt the science of climate change. I mean, and we know this because there was a memo from that meeting leaked shortly thereafter
to
the New York Times.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it literally said, I mean, the purpose of the meeting, according to the memo, it said, victory will be achieved when the public understands the uncertainties in climate science, and understands is in quotes. And one tactic that they talked about in this memo, which is available online, is that it was to reach out to kids. So they talked about partnering with the National Science Teachers Association on curriculum, which they wound up doing. Some of the American Petroleum Institute did. And they said that that was necessary to, quote, erect a barrier against future regulation. So it was not subtle what they were saying.
Right. No.
You know, they were really trying to replicate the strategy of the tobacco industry. The tobacco industry had for many decades in the 20th century, where they just pushed this out. Like, I mean, it's kind of absurd to think about today, but for a long time, people were pretty doubtful about whether cigarettes caused cancer, and then whether secondhand smoke caused cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not because the science was iffy on it, but because there were these people hired by the tobacco industry to go on TV to, you know, give talks to push forward this alternate reality that we don't really know. And of course, everybody knew somebody who'd been smoking their whole life and didn't have cancer.
Exactly.
So how could you explain that? You know, like they kind of like ginned up these questions that actually could be answered, but, you know, that made it seem like the science wasn't as settled as it was. And that allowed, you know, that allowed the tobacco industry to make money for decades longer than they might have otherwise. And so that's the exact strategy of the fossil fuel industry, is, you know, to kind of delay these regulations, delay this transition as long as they can, so they can, you know, it's a matter of trillions of dollars to them. It's not a small thing.
My mother was born in 1917. And so she smoked as a young person, you know, kind of through the 40s and 50s. And she said when she was young, they used to call cigarettes cancer sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, that was probably early 1940s when they were doing that. So, you know, it wasn't unknown.
Right.
What was going on.
People who were paying attention, it was obvious, but nonetheless, it took until basically the 80s for secondhand smoke to be regulated,
right. Yes.
70s for cigarettes to be regulated, and much later for secondhand smoke.
So your last chapter is entitled Victory. Could you talk about who will achieve victory and how that will happen?
Well, that chapter title came from that quote and from that 1998 memo. Victory will be achieved when the public, quote, understands the uncertainties in climate science. And I would argue that they succeeded, because it's been 25 years close to it, and there's still, you know, one of our two parties in this two-party system is very entrenched in doubting climate science. And still, I mean, even though there's no actual doubt in the science, right? And, you know, and like, we're still arguing over whether kids should learn about it. And there's still this vast misinformation that is trickling down to kids. And so, you know, I think I say in my book that, you know, if you ask those people what the ideal situation would look like in 2022, say, it might look like something like what we're living through today, which is that, you know, there's enough doubt about climate science that we have not actually made a major transition away from fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. We'll ask you to predict a little bit. Do you think over the next 10 years or so, public will become aware, more aware? My thought is that, you know, the catastrophes have helped to heighten awareness of climate change, although it's often anecdotal evidence that does it. We have a huge rainstorm, and everybody says, ah, now I believe in climate change. But
right.
What's likely to happen in the schools or in the general public, say, between now and 2030?
Well, you know, I always hesitate to
of course,
predict.
Yeah.
I don't always, it doesn't work out for me very often.
I know. You're a journalist, not a prophet.
That as you point out, there's only so long that climate denialism can work, just like there was only so long that doubt about cigarettes could work, right? Mm-hmm. Like eventually the evidence is so overwhelming. Today you'd be just laughed out of the room if you suggested that there was no connection between tobacco and mm-hmm. cancer. And at some point that's going to happen with this, because the evidence is so overwhelming. It's right in front of us. We're all experiencing it. And so these kids will learn at some point in their life what the reality is, and if they were miseducated, they'll learn that they were miseducated. And the question is that going to happen soon enough to forestall the worst outcomes of the climate crisis?
Right.
We hope that your book has a big part in helping to make that kind of change. I was thinking as you talk, I'd love to read your book on critical race theory and education.
Yeah, that's another one of those issues. So that's really so political.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Katie Wirth. Katie is a prize-winning journalist, author of Miseducation, a Chico alum. She's going to be speaking March 30th, 6 p.m., Chico State Campus, Calusa Hall 100. Really look forward to having you back in Chico and talking to the folks at Chico State. Thank you, Katie Wirth.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
We got no choice.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. And Steve, how about you tell people what's coming up this evening?
Well, it doesn't happen to be written down here. We have, it's on here somewhere. Bobby sent it to us. Eckert Malting and Brewing will be the subject of North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon coming up in just about 5 minutes.
And at 6:30
Ginger Nichols, Radioactive.
One big public announcements. This Way to Sustainability conference will be happening at Chico State University this Thursday and Friday. I'm pretty sure that you can register on site. It's both by Zoom and in person. And so it's at Chico State Thursday and Friday. Go first thing in the morning on Thursday so you can get registered. And then on Thursday evening, kind of happy time, the annual environmental community gathering, co-sponsored by the Butte Environmental Council and the Environmental Coalition of Butte County. It's free. It's open to the public. You don't have to go to the conference to come to this event. There will be appetizers and music and beer and wine for sale. It will be Thursday, March 24th. That's this coming Thursday, the day after tomorrow, in fact, from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Chico Women's Club, 592 East 3rd Street. And here's why you should come. This event will have over 20 representatives from the environmental community. Ecotopia will be there, and Steve will be interviewing people who come by. AltaCal Audubon will be there. Butte County Public Works, the Waste Management will be there. Grid Alternatives, the Sierra Club will be there. Smart Growth Advocates will be there. The Butte Environmental Council will have several tables. And the Mount Lassen chapter of
Native Plant Society.
Mount Lassen chapter of the Native Plant Society, Friends of Bidwell Park, Regenerating Paradise. So you people from Paradise should come and join us as well. They will all be tabling and tell you what events they are involved in. And if you are looking for a place to volunteer to help the environment, you'll have opportunities. Oh, I didn't say Chico Local Food Network or Northern California, North Valley Local Food Network. So lots of really cool people doing really cool things. So come. It'll be really great.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Thanks for listening. You can always check out our website, recordings of recent program, long list of recordings from going back several years. You can listen to them if you missed them the first time around, our list of environmental resources, and so forth. Drop us a line, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
You are the new day. Yesterday, if you can but prove to me you are the new day, send us on in time for dawn. Let the birds all hail the morning. Love of life will urge me, say. Knowing we must bear, thoughts occur that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as human
once more. Could the world and end it all? Lie around me where they fall before the new day. Before the new.
North State Give and Take is made